Classical conditioning and how to approach it will be the topic of our discussion with Nancy Decker in today's episode. Stay with us. Thank you, Nancy, for joining me today. I'm really glad to have you here. We are going to talk about classical conditioning and its application in dog training. How can we use it, especially in husband-daughter training, in everyday life? And maybe we should start with what is actually classical conditioning.
Okay. Classical conditioning... I'm always very careful to try to simplify the definition as much as possible, because I fear when we get too wordy, sometimes we can lose its true meanings or be misunderstood. So classical conditioning is pairing two stimuli, one stimulus, which is has absolutely no meaning to the dog, pairing it with a stimulus that generates an involuntary reflex in the dog. So we are pairing these two stimuli so that the first stimulus, which previously had absolutely no significance to the dog, creates the same response that the second unconditioned stimulus, in other words, a stimulus that never needed to be conditioned. It generated an involuntary response, a reflex in the dog. So we are pairing them so that the first, I don't want to use conditioned and unconditioned. I don't want to confuse or muddy the waters. Yeah. So we pair the two stimuli so that the first previously insignificant stimulus will generate the same response that the second stimulus already did.
Right. So we can give an example. Can we say that this is what we do with a clicker at the beginning, with a clicker sound?
You mean to pair it with?
With food.
Yeah, sure. Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a very, very simple example. The classic example, of course, which is, you know, actually historically incorrect, but the classic example that we all recognize is the ringing of a bell, Pavlov's use of, when he was working with dogs. The ringing of a bell, which previously means nothing to a dog, is not significant. Pairing it with the presence of food, which automatically generates an involuntary reflex, salivation, for the dog, and the sequence of events, pairing the bell before the presence of food. I think it's important that we talk about the sequence of events as well, that the unconditioned, the conditioned stimulus needs to happen before the unconditioned stimulus for the association to be made.
All right. So basically we work on reflexes responses, as you said, right? With classical conditioning.
Involuntary responses.
Responses. And how it relates to dog training? Do we use involuntary responses when we work with dogs?
You know, classical conditioning doesn't only mean that we work with involuntary responses, because we could, in the future, once that bell has been classically conditioned to mean something, we could pair something to the bell. You know, which would still be, it would be higher order conditioning, but we are still classically conditioning another item, maybe the sound of a cheese wrapper, the sound of a door opening, any other stimulus with the bell, which now has a significance to the dog. We are still classically conditioning two stimuli together.
Okay, so it's like a ladder. We can go up with the stimuli that we use. So we have
going forever. Yeah. We can keep conditioning things, pairing things together so that the dog, and I say the dog because we are talking about dog training, but really any being, but the dog, so that the dog makes an association. We can, as long as we control when the stimuli happen, and we control the sequence of events, and that we make sure that every time that first stimulus occurs, the second one also occurs every single time then the association is made.
Okay, so the sequence is important, as you said.
The sequence is crucial. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
It's crucial. And we hear in dog training world that Pavlov, the father of classical conditioning, is always on your shoulder. What does it mean? How can we explain it to the people? What does it mean that Pavlov is always there?
Well, I think what we need to remember when we're working with dogs is that classical conditioning or associations are made regardless of whether we're controlling them or not. They're happening. So I think that the better we are as trainers, the more conscious we are of this, and to make sure that we try to control these situations, these contexts as much as possible in order to get the result that we want. But we need to remember that no matter what we're doing, classical conditioning is taking place all the time.
Oh, this is so important to remember that this can actually change how the dog, how our training goes and whatever we do. So classical conditioning is very important. It's not only operant conditioning we do with dogs.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of talk too about in the dog training circles that in order to affect emotional responses, we use classical conditioning. And in order to affect behavior, we use operant conditioning. And I think that many trainers might get caught in a trap thinking that those two are completely different and separate things, not realizing that they work together all the time. And that we can only affect emotions by working with classical conditioning. And that's not entirely true. We can affect an emotional response through operant conditioning. It's probably, I think that if trainers rely too much on operant conditioning to try to affect an emotional change or an emotional response in a dog, I think that some of them might accidentally slip into flooding if they do that. If they rely too much on trying to use the ABCs of operant conditioning to affect emotion, I think that sometimes they might be slipping into dangerous territory where they could turn it into flooding. So, which is why I think, pardon?
They can mask what the dog actually feels about what they do with operant conditioning.
Possibly, I'm not, can you give me an example?
For example, like with flooding, the dog will still do the behavior.
Oh yes.
Or the consequence, but this will mask the deeper thing that we talk about right now. So classical conditioning may have a different effect than the operant conditioning.
Yes, yes. A different one that we intended as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And we see that a lot in husbandry training as well. Or you and I had a conversation recently too about wearing harness. You were working on that with your dog, and I'm also working on that with my dog. And that's something where when we're using rewards, when we're using reinforcers, and we're trying to help the dog feel better about or have a better positive response to his harness, but we're using rewards, and he may be offering us behaviors because of the reward, but we're not actually making him feel any better about the harness. And if we're not very, very careful to notice that he's actually just working for the reward, he's not really into his harness, we can create a different association, one that we did not intend to. And I see your face, and I do it too. We all do it. And that's why I see that. That's why we have to be extra alert and conscious, because Pavlov is always on your shoulder, and we have to be very, very aware of that. And it happens. It's not that if it happens, it's not that we're a terrible trainer. What's important is to notice it immediately and to adjust our approach.
Yes. I don't know if you remember my video, because you definitely saw it with Gatsik and harness when it was the first video I showed you in your class. with Gatsik, and I was working on operant behavior with Harness, and he was doing it, but you could see by his body posture and everything he did that it was not actually the response I would like to have in the future.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it was contingent on the reinforcer being there.
Yeah.
I don't think that he would have offered the same behavior without the reinforcement.
No, there'd be more backing and just leaving the place and going somewhere else.
But it looked like he was, you know, it looked like
he was engaged.
What was happening. Absolutely. Yeah. And he was doing the behavior that we wanted, and it was being reinforced. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is where I say sometimes that can work. Mm-hmm. Sometimes with enough repetition, we can change his emotional response using operant conditioning. But I think it's a gamble. And I think that, I don't think that most of us are good enough trainers to be able to rely on something like that. And that we should try as much as possible to separate our methods and our exercises.
Okay. Yes, because you said that we could. It's a gamble because Pavlov is there. It's like classical conditioning. It's happening, and you can change it just by working on a behavior, because this what the dogs the response is not it's the dog's choice. I mean, it's the organism is choosing the response. So. Yes. We need to be really careful when we work, especially on behaviors that may be challenging for the dog. So it goes to husbandry training and all the behaviors that are considered not pleasant. And yes. How can we use classical conditioning? How can we use those unconditioned reflexes to work for us?
Huh. Well, it's a science, so we can't cheat. Mm. We can't, first of all, we can't make the process go any faster than we want it to go. We can't make it go, I need to reword that. We can't make it go as fast as we want it to go.
Yes.
We need to progress at the dog's speed, whatever that may be. And if we're dealing with a stimulus that is neutral to him and we are creating a new response, that can happen pretty quickly and pretty seamlessly. But if we're dealing with something to which he already has formed a negative association, then we're talking about counter conditioning. We're starting from much further, and we need to be much more careful and move systematically and very gradually, and which is why systematic desensitization and counter conditioning usually work hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Particular methods, very gradual exposures while we help him build a new association. And again, sequence of events here is crucial. Mm-hmm. Presentation of one stimulus before the other.
Okay, and this is actually the opposite of flooding.
Yes, yes. Systematic desensitization absolutely is the opposite of flooding. Not that flooding can't work.
Of course,
it can work, but it can really go badly, and it can backfire. And it's not a very kind thing to do. It's ethically
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And because you said it's, if we have a neutral stimuli, it's much easier. So we should take it into consideration when we work with our dogs and when we teach them some husbandry training, some behaviors we often forget about. And this is much easier when you start from the zero point than when you start with minus 100, for example. And
yes.
I think this is what happens very often in the husbandry training, that we skip that part. I mean, we focus on sit, we focus on down, we focus on some obedience training, and we forget that the husbandry training is actually the biggest part of our life with dogs, that we need to trim the nails, we need to wear harness practically every day. And when we skip that part of classically conditioning the response to the harness, to nail trimmer, we start from the point minus. And
yes,
it's not easy.
Yeah. And I think that the way that it happens, and the reason that it happens so easily and almost predictably with just about every dog, is that the first time that we put the harness on, the first time that we clip nails, those associations are being made, but we might not be seeing such a strong response on behalf of the dog. He could, you know, we could be trimming his nails and he could be confused and not liking it and not really, you know, and it might take several repetitions before he finally says, you know what, no, I'm not putting that harness on today. So not only are we missing the chance to build a positive association from the beginning, we are inadvertently or accidentally creating a negative association, and we don't know it until it's too late. And now we have to start counter conditioning and desensitization, which is of course 10 times the amount of work. And doesn't always work. It doesn't always work. I need to clarify that. What I mean is, I think that a lot of people think that classical conditioning or counter conditioning is getting a dog to a point where he likes something that he previously disliked or feared. And that's not necessarily true. I think that we can, if we're lucky, we'll get to a point where the dog will tolerate it well and no longer fear it or no longer dislike it. And the example that I like to use is if somebody is afraid of the dentist, afraid of going to the dentist, we might be able to use a classical conditioning to get the person to overcome their fear and to tolerate a treatment or a dental treatment. But I'm pretty sure we're never going to get them to enjoy a root canal or a tooth extraction. that's asking for a lot. So I think that when we're working with dogs to help them overcome a fear or to help them turn around a negative association, I don't think that our goal should be to expect that they will now like the thing that they previously feared. I think that we need to reach a point where they're either neutral or, and that's good. Neutral is good.
Neutral,
I think that's
very good.
Goal, yes. Or at least to a point where they tolerate it because it's necessary, like nail trims.
Yeah.
But I'd like to talk about some of the things that we might think are extremely important, but might not be necessary. Like harnesses, for example. Is a harness really necessary, and why is the dog uncomfortable with the harness? If I look at my own dog, it's a physical response. I think that the physical sensation of having the harness on for him is absolutely unpleasant, and I don't think I'll ever get him to like it. I've gotten him to tolerate it, but I see he doesn't like it, and he has a threshold after about an hour of wearing it. He's had it. He wants it off. Mm-hmm. And I have to think to myself, is it crucial that I have my dog wear a harness? I know that in some cases, there may be a medical reason why a dog needs to wear a harness instead of a collar, but if not, if a dog can wear a collar, when I say wear a collar, if we can attach a leash to a collar, the dog isn't pulling, the dog isn't jumping, he's not hurting himself, why don't we do that instead? Why shouldn't we look for a simpler solution to the problem rather than trying to throw science at it to get it?
Good, really, because sometimes like the antecedent arrangement and choosing a different solution is what we can do instead of really trying to change the dog's behavior. We can change the thing we want to use.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I like to give an example too of dogs who dogs who bark outside the window, dogs who are aroused by seeing things outside, whether it's cars or people or other dogs or motion outside the window. We could, of course, design a very elaborate plan to desensitize or counter condition the dog to try to train a new behavior in the presence of a certain stimulus. That's a big complicated plan when we could instead manage the situation or antecedent arrangement where we could put frosted decal on the window to
prevent access.
The control is access to the visual access to whatever it is that's making him bark, and it's a much simpler solution.
Absolutely,
and it is a band-aid solution in that we're not we're not really solving the behavior issue, because if we take, you know, if we open the curtains or remove the decals, the dog will bark again. But from personal experience, having done that with a dog that went bananas when she saw something moving outside the windows, and I applied the decal with the intention of going into a very elaborate training program for her, I never did it. And the decals were up for the 6 remaining years of her life, and I never trained it, and it was perfect. It worked.
And it worked, because sometimes we can do that. We simply can change. Of course. Sometimes it's easier for all of us, because very often we need to remember that the training needs to be done very well in order to be successful. And very often we as handlers are to be blamed for lack of success, that our timing was not correct, the sequence of events was not correct. And very often that we can't control the environment. Yes. And sometimes it's crucial, because it's like the example I had with Gatsik and Harness. It is really difficult for him, because he has a health issue. He can't wear a collar. So he has to wear harness. And it is really hard at first to just take the harness away, because you need to do that. You need to first change this, that he's not wearing harness, in order to work on it.
Yes.
And if you have a chance to wear a collar and it's not harming your dog, then I would definitely do that instead of all the work. And I don't think he will ever be really enjoying his harness. It's working right now. It's really much better than it was.
Yes.
But it's not going to be perfect, but it's okay. I don't think we are going for perfect, right?
Right. Right. I think that is a very important point. I don't think, in my personal view, even as a professional trainer, I don't think perfect is ever necessary.
Yeah. But
I'm not involved in any sort of training that requires perfection. Mm-hmm. If somebody is training for sports, or if somebody is training for obedience trials, yeah, or where perfection or very precise behaviors are very important. I work with pet dogs where perfection is never important. That I know of. I mean, I can't think of an example where a perfect behavior would be important. I think, though, that as long as trainers, when we're dealing with clients, with handlers and their dogs, as long as they are happy with the result, and as long as the dog is happy, as long as his quality of life is positively affected, I think that pretty much any solution is good, as long as it's good for both the handler and the dog.
Absolutely. Yeah. A few days ago, I was doing, I was recording one of the episodes with my friend, a trainer from Australia, and we were talking about what we should teach the pet dog owners that is important. And we came to a conclusion that it is important to teach them that dogs are dogs and some behaviors are normal, that you don't need to strive to the video you saw on YouTube with a perfectly obedient dog. And yes, the dogs, they bark. They do various things because this is not normal. And we shouldn't really be focusing on making them a puppet, right?
Yes. And where did that come from? Where did we move away, so far away from normal dog behavior?
Yeah.
Incredible to me how important it's become to people to really suppress these behaviors and to try to modify perfectly normal dog behavior. But I think too that there's a lot of social pressure involved, where people feel that certain behavior is not normal or not acceptable and it needs to be changed. And I think that as trainers, I think that we have a responsibility to help them understand what is normal dog behavior. And often it makes them go, oh, well, it's normal, then I don't need to worry about it anymore. But again, you know, coming back to our main topic of classical conditioning, I think that as long as we do our very best to help improve the quality of life for the dog and their handler. And using classical conditioning, like you say, from the very beginning to help them understand that, you know, your puppy's nails will need to be clipped all the time, regularly. So let's get working on that. And he'll need to wear a harness. Let's get working on that. As long as we can get those things, those messages across, rather than your dog needs to heal on the left-hand side. Let's start this now at 9 weeks old. You know, that can wait. Let's start with the husbandry. Let's start using some classical conditioning to get the dog to enjoy things that are going to be part of his normal life.
Absolutely. This is very, very important. I think that if all people started with puppies, if they started going to the vet and doing classical conditioning, I mean, the vet experience doesn't have to be, does it have to be unpleasant? Can we make it neutral, the vet experience?
I think that we can make a large part of it at least neutral in that it is familiar and not scary. I think if we can remove the element of fear, then, you know, when we are actually at the vet with a problem, which is when the dog will be stressed, is when the dog will be fearful or will be, could be aggressive because, you know, he's in pain. So if we can do whatever we can do in the very beginning to make the experience of going into the animal hospital, meeting the staff members, of being in an exam room and having created a positive association with that, it will greatly reduce the stress level when we actually need to be in there for a health issue.
And there what are other behaviors? What would you say we forget? What behaviors we just skip during early phases with our dog that may be necessary in future, that we may benefit in doing some classical conditioning training?
Well, and this will sound weird coming from me because I don't use crates. I use them with puppies. I use crates to facilitate house training and at times to confine the puppy when it needs to be confined for safety reasons or whatever. But I think that for some people who may be involved in dog sport, travel frequently with their dog, I think what's important is to, and of course we're assuming here that everyone has a puppy. Not everybody adopts puppies, but we're lucky enough to start with a puppy. I think that if we can establish first clearly in our mind what lifestyle we expect this dog to have. Do I foresee my car or my dog being in the car often? Do I foresee my dog needing any specific or particular skills as an adult? Well, we would need to begin now to help him form positive associations with whatever is involved in that scenario. So if it's riding in the car, if it's being in crowds, you know, or being in a dog sport venue. I can't remember your question. Was your question
what behaviors, I mean, what can we focus on before it goes bad? What can benefit our life in future?
Our life and the dog's life.
Of course, like our get together.
what I think people don't realize either is the importance of the association the dog makes with our presence, our mere presence. You know, that when we are interacting with our dog, as much as possible, if we can make every interaction a positive experience for him, there will be negative or scary or unpleasant interactions between us and our dogs in the future. And I think that it would be unrealistic to think that that wouldn't happen. You know, that one day we lose our cool or we get angry or we yell or we, you know, it happens. And I think that if we consciously make every interaction as possible, as positive as possible, when we first have our dog, whether he's a puppy or an adult, you know, the first interactions, and to make sure that our presence means good things to our dog, and this is all part of classical conditioning as well. those moments when we have to, you know, I'm sorry, buddy, I have to put you in the car and take you to the vet, or you know, I'm going to have to, you need this emergency treatment. I'm going to have to hold your head now. I think that if we have created such a positive link between us and our dogs using classical conditioning, then it's easier to get through those really tough moments.
All right. Just like a bank of trust.
Yes. Yes. Of course. The Susan Friedman's word, the trust account. Yeah. Building the trust account.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That is very, very important.
All right. This is, and what if we don't have a puppy, as you said, because not all people have puppies. They they have rescue dogs, or they have an adult dog that already has a bad association. Does it mean that we shouldn't really, we are starting from minus. We don't start with neutral. But people often get confused here and they ask, if I feed my dog when he has some issues, let's say with the vet, am I not reinforcing his fear?
And you know, I know that we say you can't reinforce fear, you can't reinforce an emotion, and I think that's unclear. I think that when we say that, people hear it, but they don't understand, how is that possible? Because you've just told me that when he does something, if I give him a reward, I will reinforce that behavior. So it's very hard to try to clarify separating emotion and behavior. And I think that it's important to when we talk about this with our clients, I think it's important to teach when we are trying to change an emotional response, that behavior doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the dog is doing at that point. If you are helping him make an association between one thing and another, don't worry about his behavior yet. And we will see a change. You will begin to see when the emotion begins to change and you can see that he is starting to make a more positive or neutral association between this stimuli. Then you can sort of graduate to operant conditioning, and then you can start asking or expecting behaviors before you start reinforcing. So if a dog is, I'm trying to think of an example here, a real life example. If I'm walking with my dog and I know that my dog is, for a lack of a better term, reactive towards other dogs. If I know that my dog is reactive towards other dogs, and when we are walking and I see that he has seen the other dog and he's very alert and I feed him, it doesn't matter whether he's standing or sitting or lying down or on my left, or I don't care what his behavior is. As long as he's seeing the stimulus and I am feeding him something spectacular. I'm not going to bring out kibble for something like that or regular food. I'm going to bring out awesome food. I will do this until I see a change in his response, until I see that he's able to look up at the dog and not respond and not be super alert or standing up straight and his ears forward and his body stiff. If I can see that at a certain distance now he's starting to be relaxed, then I can start maybe asking for a sit. If I want, I can start asking for a sit before I reward him. So although I'm doing the same thing in the presence of a dog, I am feeding my dog in the beginning. It doesn't matter what he's doing. I'm trying to influence his emotion. And later on, when I have influenced the emotion, then I can start influencing his behavior. If that makes sense.
Yes, and it makes sense because basically people forget very often with classical conditioning is that you don't require a certain behavior. You just feed, for example, your dog. I mean, you're just giving great food you have. It doesn't matter, as you said, what the dog does. So, but you can see a change in an operant behavior with classical conditioning very often, right? Like when we classically condition and stimulate, And we work on counter conditioning. So as in your example, the dog was alerted where he when he saw another dog, you just work on classically conditioning, counter conditioning in this case, right? His response. You will see a change in his operant behavior also. What he has learned before, how to behave in the presence of a dog, this will also change when
yes.
Response, classically conditioned response will change. It will also influence the behavior, operant behavior.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And if there is a particular behavior that we want to mm-hmm. train, if there is something that we would like him to do yeah. in the presence of another dog, then it would be the right time to mm-hmm. affect that once we have already changed his emotional response. But this is where I say that I think that some people say, well, why can't I just ask him to sit when he sees another dog? And by sitting, won't he feel more relaxed?
Yeah.
And that is very unclear, very muddy waters because, yes, it's true that you can affect behavior through operant conditioning. Mm-hmm. But I think that that is very hard. And that's where I say that we can accidentally flood. You know, when we were talking about your dog with the harness mm-hmm. before where, okay, he'll do the behavior because he knows that there is a reward, there is a reinforcer at the end mm-hmm. of it, but are we really affecting his emotional response to the sight of the other dog? I'm not sure that we are. We might be.
Even worse with Gatsig and the harness, it got even worse.
and that is a possibility. So it's a gamble, mm-hmm. Which is why I think it's best when we are classically conditioning the presence of another dog, in this case, if we're talking mm-hmm. about a dog being reactive to another dog, the presence of another dog equals food, guaranteed. It doesn't matter what you do.
Yeah.
When that dog is there, the food is going to happen, guaranteed. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about operant conditioning, of course, is in the presence of this stimulus, in the presence of the other dog, if you do this behavior, food will happen.
Consequences will follow, yes.
Exactly. So I think it's important to start with the guarantee. Mm-hmm. And then once you start to see it affect, and I guess you're right, you know, if in order to be able to tell whether his emotional response is affected, his behavior will be different.
Yeah.
And that's how we can tell. Yeah.
That's what, how we read emotions, right? How we,
yes.
Because they can't tell us how they feel. So yes. We have to rely on behavior.
And I can see that we're going down this slippery slope now where we're going to be, how do you read emotions? How can you tell? How can you, and that is a whole other debate.
Oh yeah. This is very,
I am not qualified to get into.
Yes, I'm very I am scared to talk about emotions because it's really deep topic. And this is,
it is
something, especially with someone who's working and has something to do with ABA, emotions and how you speak about them and how you say that you influence emotions. This is really a different topic for another conversation because it's like, wow, is there something there that we could talk about actually?
How do you quantify? How do you measure? How do you...
How do you tell that this is fear and not fear with, I'm lacking emotions.
This is a topic that can paralyze me.
Me too. So yes, we can. Absolutely. But classical conditioning is about unconditioned reflexes, right?
Yes.
And basically this is what you change. This is emotions because we know they are there. We absolutely are sure every living creature has emotions, right? So dogs, they have emotions. But when we use classical conditioning, we work on unconditioned reflexes, but we also change emotions using, because it's an association we make.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When you say we work on unconditioned reflexes, mm-hmm. We work on pairing things.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
To elicit that same sort of unconditioned. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just shortcut.
Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely. And I think this was important what you said about the fact that we can't reinforce fear, and that we should focus just on classical conditioning part of the equation when we have a problem. And this is something like I like to, because many people say that, but yes, you are feeding the dog when he behaves badly, right? When he behaves in a way I don't like it. But when you go and think about even yourself, that if I am afraid of snakes, let's say, and I am somewhere in the vicinity of the snake, and someone is giving me sushi because I love sushi, this would absolutely not reinforce my feelings and how I feel about, I mean, this will not make my feelings stronger, the bad feelings, I mean, the fear feelings stronger when I get sushi. It may even change my response to the positive way.
Well, it depends.
It depends.
And I think that this, I think that this is why it is so important when we are working on counter conditioning to consider the desensitization part of it. Because if, for example, I am too close, my dog is too close to the other dog and is barking, trying to feed my dog yummy cheese during that time, my dog is over threshold. So I will probably just forego the food and get my dog out of that situation.
Yes.
We've gone too far. Let's do something else. So if you are in a room with a snake and are screaming, chances are sushi is not going to do a whole lot for you right there.
Sushi that moment, probably.
No. So if you are receiving sushi because you are seeing a snake at a very safe distance and you are not really responding fearfully, so this is where I think that the argument of whether or not we are reinforcing a negative emotion or reinforcing bad behavior, being something that is not desired.
Yes.
Chances are we're doing it wrong if that's what's happening, because the dog is way over threshold. He is too close to that stimulus.
Yeah.
That's
why we should start with neutral stimulus. Because it's easier.
Yes, of course, it's easier. Yeah, and before we engage in any sort of treatment using desensitization or counter conditioning, or even before we engage in a plan to positively to create a positive association between two stimuli, yeah. I think that we need to practice our skills. We need to know. To really understand the importance of the sequence and the timing. And they are skills. They are mechanical skills. And I think that we need to practice them. And if you'll remember that in class, one of the first things we did was just practice our skills, because, you know, we understand the concept. Yeah, I get it. I present the first stimulus and then I immediately present it. Yeah, I got it. But then when you actually go to practice it, It's not easy. It's just that we need to create a muscle memory. We need to create the ability to present one thing then the other. And when you talked about classically conditioning a dog to a clicker, you know, to have him make the association between a clicker and the food, well, people who are new to clicker training, it can be very confusing. You know, it's click and then reach for the food. And new trainers, we often see them click and reach for the food at the same time. And I gave an example in my class, a real life example of people sometimes, instead of clicking and throwing the food, they throw the clicker.
Yes, it happens.
Because it's a mechanic skill. It's a choreography. Steps have to happen in a certain order. So we need to practice with things that are unimportant first, just to get our mechanical skills. And when I say unimportant, I use the example in class of classically conditioning a completely benign stimulus, something that means nothing to our dog. And for an example, what's that?
like a bottle of water, for example?
Yeah, exactly. And in the example that I gave with my own dog, it was an ice cube tray. Just to, you know, where I presented that to him and it meant nothing to him. And then I presented the food and I repeated that enough so that when I pulled out an ice cube tray now, he's like, yeah. But it could have gone wrong. I could have presented them at the same time, or I could have presented the food and then the tray, and I would not have succeeded in classically conditioning the response that I was looking for. So it's important, I think, as trainers to practice with insignificant items like an ice cube tray or a pen, or to practice our mechanical skills before we start trying to work with the important stuff.
And with counter conditioning, which is even
more especially difficult. When we're working with something the dog is already afraid of. Mm-hmm.
And we can make classical conditioning work against us, right? Not in our favor. We can do it. We can make the dog actually have a bad response.
Yes.
This is two ways, right? It's not only one way.
Yes. Yes. And that is, I think, where the importance of sequence of events comes in. You know, I see people sometimes smearing peanut butter or putting something that the dog really likes in front of them. And when the dog starts to eat, then they start clipping their nails, thinking that the dog is distracted. And it could work for, you know, several times, but the dog is making an association where now every time you present that food, he thinks, oh God, no, not my
peanut
nails.
Butter. No peanut butter.
No. Yeah. No peanut butter ever again. Yeah. He hates peanut butter now. So that's entirely possible. And it's 100% due to the sequence of events, what is presented first and what is presented second.
Yes. Yes. Because in the example with peanut butter, you have an unconditioned stimulus first. No, the neutral one.
I'm sorry, say again.
In the example with a peanut butter smeared on the wall or in a yes. place, you have a opposite sequence.
Yes. Right? Yes.
The first is
exactly.
the unconditioned stimuli, and then yes. is the neutral stimuli, or
yes.
the aversive in this case, probably.
Yeah, or it could have been neutral, but becomes aversive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. Wow, classical conditioning is really, it's like, we don't talk about it a lot. We focus on reinforcing behavior, and we forget that there is a really big part of how we can influence the association. And I think we talked about husbandry training, but also when I consider dog sports, that how we work with them, if we use some traditional ways of training, or if we use positive training, it not only matters in terms of behaviors you teach, but also with what reflex response you will condition to the stimulus of training session and all the events that happens. So this matters all the time.
All the time. All the time. And I think that the better trainers mm-hmm. are aware of that mm-hmm. before an association is even made. Right. You know, they are very keenly aware of the environment and what association the dog might be making, might be in the process of making before it's actually made. And that's, I think that comes with practice. That comes with a lot of practice. That comes with being able to read the dog's body language, and that comes with practice. It's a skill.
Yes.
It's not so much an art and a talent as it is a skill. We can learn these things just through observation and through being around really good trainers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So to give people, and to sum up our conversation, and to give people also a tip, we should start, if we want to try classical conditioning, we want to work with a neutral stimuli, we should consider the sequence of event, our mechanics, as you said, and the proximity also to the stimuli to make sure it's not being aversive. to the animal. What else would you say we can add?
When you say proximity, do you mean timing, or do you mean
the proximity? The it's like when you present even a neutral stimuli, you can present it in a way that it's too close to the animal.
Oh yes, that's a good point. Yes, that's a very good point. Where the personal space. That's an excellent point. So is your question, what is the sequence, or how can we do this? Or
what else we should remember when we work on classical conditioning? So we have a sequence of events. We have our mechanical skills we should practice and went with. What else we should remember when we want to work on classical conditioning?
Well, and the timing between the appearance of each stimulus, there can't be too long of a delay. Mm. It has to be very quickly, very quickly paired, very quickly matched for the dog to make the correct association. And I think that it's important for people to remember too, that not only when we're classical conditioning, when we're using classical conditioning, but when we're using counter conditioning especially, that it takes time to be patient. It takes a lot of repetition. It takes a lot of repetition to make an association that will last. And then remembering that the dog has made this negative association and it is quite anchored, it has lasted, it's going to take a while to turn that around. So we need to be patient, and we need to understand that if it's not happening quickly, it's not the dog's fault, and we need to keep working at it at his pace and to not expect it to be perfect, that we're not aiming for the dog to be super happy about something that was previously aversive. We should aim for a neutral response.
And I would add it to it also, don't focus on behavior. This is about behavior.
Not yet. Yeah.
Not yet. Yes.
Yeah. We are actually doing this in order to be able to influence the behavior in the way that we, if we want to train a behavior. And we don't always want to train a behavior. Sometimes we just want to change the dog's emotional response to something. And that's okay.
Absolutely. Thank you, Nancy. I really enjoyed this one.
This has been fun. Yeah.
And I think this is such an important topic. And very often we forget that we can have our both life, ours and our dog's easier just by investing some time before things go wrong. And this is something we should remember, and maybe try with a neutral stimuli and work and see how it influences the future, because I think it's a really good investment.
That's an excellent point. And I would add that if something does go wrong sometimes, and it often does, that we don't always need to fix it, that sometimes it's okay to manage it. I think people are afraid of management, and I think management is perfectly fine as long as it improves the life of the dog as well as ours.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I hope it's not the last time we see each other here.
Thank you so much. Again, this has been a lot of fun.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm